From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about the place you go if you really want to get something done. Jason Fried, the software designer and co-founder of the popular company 37 Signals, asks this question all the time. Where do you go to actually work? And most people say on the commute or on the porch at home or at a coffee shop. The point is, hardly anyone answers the office. Fried says the modern workplace is just wrong. Its structure is off because it's built around people interrupting you. Think about most offices. You've got people walking around, asking you what you think, having meeting after meeting. And for Fried, meetings are the worst. He calls them terrible and toxic. Today in the program, Jason Fried is with us to talk about work and how you redesign the workplace to actually get some work done. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. These days, in the era of big innovative companies like Apple or Pixar, you often hear about a new corporate culture. And often these places have a campus rather than an office. You can pretty much dress however you want. There's stuff like Skittles and bowls and cold cereal in the break room and ping pong tables. But Jason Fried says you don't create a culture of work. It just happens. A culture, he says, is a byproduct of consistent behavior. Culture is action, not words. And so it doesn't really matter if you have a foosball table or hammocks, if you don't have the right environment for people to actually get some work done. Jason Fried is a software designer and the co-founder of a very popular company called 37 Signals. And lately, he's been getting a lot of attention for his ideas about that, about redesigning the modern workplace. Right now, most workplaces, he says, are designed to pretty much interrupt people with chatter and managers wandering around in meetings, always meetings. The real work, he says, gets done in other places at other times, at home or really early in the morning. Today on the program, Jason Fried is joining us to talk about work. And Jason Fried is the co-founder and president of 37 Signals. It's a company that designs and builds web-based productivity software. In 2010, he presented a TED Talk entitled Why Work Doesn't Happen at Work. He's also co-author alongside David Heinemeier Hansen of the book Rework. He's joining us today from his office in Chicago. And I wanted to begin by getting a sense of how you started thinking about all of this. But I kind of want to go way back at first. I mean, you've talked about, I read this interview where you were talking about how you used to love the annual reports that your father got in the mail. He was a stock investor, and they made you realize, you said, that you wanted to be a designer. And I was interested in that. What is it that you loved about that? Was it the aesthetics about it? Was it the kind of the sense of order about that?
Yeah, it was sort of the first time I ever remember information being presented in a way that I enjoyed looking at it. He used to get, back, I don't know when this was, in the 80s or something, right?
Right.
People would, or companies would, write these annual reports and make them really beautiful. They'd put a lot of money into them. They'd be glossy paper and lots of great photography and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I remember really seeing something like that, other than a textbook from school or just a book that I'd picked up that wasn't really beautiful in the same way as an annual report was. So when I used to see those, I always just loved seeing them come in the mail and then just flipping through them and really appreciating how they looked and the effort. I felt like there must have been a lot of effort that went into it. So it was sort of a magical object for me.
Do you think being a designer is in some way directly connected to the way you've been thinking about work? In the sense that, you know, is it about the kind of the elegant structures that you think about in design or efficiencies that you're getting at in design? I mean, are they connected, the two?
I think so. I think just like you design a product or you design a menu at a restaurant or whatever, you also design your business.
Yeah.
And there are certain elements of it that go into it. You know, you need to have employees, probably you need to generate revenue and all this sort of thing. But there's a lot of different ways to deal with employees, a lot of different ways to deal with generating revenue, and a lot of different ways to deal with the physical environment where you work or the virtual environment where you work. So I always look at it as it's a problem just like any other problem, in that you have to do a lot of different things together so they work in harmony. And so how can you address those, and how can you consider those in different ways? So for me, I think of business as a design problem, just like I think of building a product as a design problem.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out if this is a left brain thing or a right brain thing. I know those are probably artificial constructs at this point, but I mean, do you think of yourself, for example, as particularly creative? Because I get a sense that in some ways this is a lot about kind of sort of putting aside the past or putting aside old ideals and being imaginative enough to think of a new concept.
I hope I'm creative. Hope that I'd be considered creative. For me, I've always approached pretty much everything this way, which is asking why. I ask why about everything. You know, why is it this way and why is it that way? Why can't it be better, or why can't it be different? And not just for the sake of the exercise so much, although that's valuable in itself. I just look at things and I go, there's got to be a better way to do this, got to be a better way to do that. And I've had a lot of jobs growing up, and I've worked for a lot of different managers in a lot of different places and a lot of different companies. And every time I worked at those places, I'm like, I know I could do this better, or this could be better, or this is an uncomfortable situation that could be removed from the work process. And so for me, I'm constantly asking why, and even with our own business today, we're constantly changing the way we do things because I know there's got to be better ways to do things that we do. So it's analytical, and it's creative, and it's just, you know, it's also a little bit of impatience. Yeah. Like, there's got to be a better way. Let's just figure this out. Let's try something instead of just waiting for things to happen.
Yeah. So what's the basic there's a kind of a basic question that you ask people or used to ask people, you probably still do all the time, and here's the question that you talked about: where do you really want to go when you really need to get something done? I mean, that's an important question that you are asking people. What's contained in that question that you're getting at?
Well, I started thinking about this myself maybe 15 years ago because I was working on my own at the time in my apartment. And then I went to work with some other people for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, well, I've worked with other people in the past, but like as a first full-time job, I started working with some other people. And I realized that I started getting less and less stuff done when more and more people were around.
Right.
And I kept just thinking about, man, why is that? Why am I getting less stuff done? I feel like aren't you supposed to get more stuff done? There's this more energy and more collaboration and all these things. But what you realize when you really sit down and look at it is that more people around typically means more opportunities for interruption. And interruption is the enemy of creative work, I think, because especially in the software world or the design world or any creative endeavor, really, you need long stretches of uninterrupted time to get stuff done because you have to really think about a problem deeply. You have to see it from different angles. And it's hard to do that in 15-minute increments when you're interrupted. So this is something I started thinking about a long time ago. And then I began asking other people and noticing other people's work patterns. And very rarely does someone say, I need to get something done, so I'm going to go to the office at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. That's where it's going to happen.
Right.
Usually, it doesn't happen there.
Yeah.
And everyone knows this is sort of the truth these days. So it usually happens, you know, late at night or early in the morning when no one's around, or on the weekend or outside of the office. That's where people get – or on a flight is another good example. A lot of people get a lot of great work done on a flight because it's like 3 hours of uninterrupted time.
Yeah.
And so just like being honest about that. It made me realize that the office is not a place where people actually go to get work done. It's a place they go to be seen and to sort of participate in all the other things that happen at work, which are not work. Things
right.
like meetings and proof that you're valuable by just physically being in a space, that
yeah.
sort of stuff. And so I didn't want to create a culture like that at 37 Signals. So we don't really care where you work as long as you get the work done.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Managers, and you've talked about this, when you hear about employees who say, I want to get some work done from home, how is that? There's something that kicks in with some managers that cannot be right because they're probably imagining the kinds of distractions at home. You know, you've got your iPad there, you've got the TV, you've got the refrigerator, there's the couch. But you talk about how these aren't the things that are really distracting for workers because they are what you call voluntary distractions. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Okay, let's take that case. Let's say you're working at home. Well, you do have the refrigerator and you might have the backyard if you live in a place where you have one of those, and you might have the dog and you might have all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so fine. But at work, you have very similar things. The problem is that you might not have the dog at work and the fridge at work, but you have other things that that take you away from work. The problem is that when you're at work, you must do these other things when someone asks you to. If your manager calls you over and wants to pull you into a conference call or a meeting, you can't really say no to that. I mean, you, I guess, kind of can, but at a certain point, you really can't. It's not up to you. These are mandatory interruptions. At home, if you need to go to the fridge to get something to drink or make a sandwich, like, you can decide when the right time is for that. So if you're deep in thought, working on a problem, you can maybe push that off for 45 minutes and then get your sandwich later. So you have more control over when you're being interrupted. And that's the key point because, like I said earlier, if you're working on something and you're working on something creative, you know that you need to be in the zone. You need to be deep in thought and have uninterrupted time. And so if you are getting hungry, you can sort of postpone that hungriness, but you can't postpone a meeting that's coming up at 1 o'clock because your boss pulls you in. So I don't think that distractions are all created equal. I think the ones that you can decide when to participate in are far more valuable than the ones that you have to do because someone else tells you to, and those are happening all the time at work. So those are very invaluable, and I'd rather have valuable things than invaluable things.
The metaphor you came up with is this connection between sleep and work, in the sense that if you think about sleep, and I want to have you kind of take us through this, it's phased. We have these stages of sleep. You know, we start off at a kind of semi-conscious state, but eventually we work our way to REM. We're at sleep, and if we're lucky, it's good sleep. You say work should be the same kind of way, or at least the way we pay attention should be the same kind of stage, I guess.
Yeah, and just to make sure everyone's clear, I'm not a scientist, and there's no scientific data on this, or maybe there is. I'm not aware of it, though. But the way I look at it is
it's an observation. Right?
It's purely an observation. Yeah. You know, you go to sleep. And your head doesn't hit the pillow and you're sleeping. You know, it takes time to get into that sleep. And there's different levels, like you said, or different stages, and REM sleep's a really valuable sleep. And if you don't get that, you're not really sleeping in the whole thing. So I just thought about that one day because when you go to work, you don't just sit down in the morning at 9 a.m. or whatever and begin doing deep, important work. You need to sort of get into that. You need to move into that. And the only way to do that is to have some time and you sort of slide into it. And then if someone wakes you up from your work, just like if someone wakes you up at night, you don't fall immediately back to sleep. You're interrupted and you have to kind of go back through those phases again. The same thing's true at work. So if you're working on a really hard problem for 15, 20, 30 minutes, and then someone calls your name or pulls you into a meeting, you know, and then you are expected to go back to work and pick up where you left off. Well, you just aren't going to pick up where you left off. That's just not how we all work. So it takes you time to get back into that. And so if you think about that, no one in their right mind would imagine that someone would get a good night's sleep if they're interrupted every 45 minutes by someone else or something like that or some sound or whatever. So why do we expect people can get a good day's work if they're interrupted all day long? It just doesn't make sense to me. So that's where I see the parallel between sleep and work. And if you can't get a good night's sleep being interrupted all night, then you're not going to get a good night's work or good day's work by being interrupted all day. So I think they're really close parallels, and I'd be curious to see if there is some research on that. But I would bet that that's a pretty good parallel.
I know it's not particularly scientific, but have you ever sort of figured out what's the chunk of time, maybe for you, where you're the most productive? Is it 1 hour? Is it 2 hours? Do you need to take a break? I mean, what is that? Have you ever timed that?
You know, for me, it's not even so much the length, although it is the length of time, but it's also when the time happens. Yeah. So for me, I'm more creative at night. I like darkness when I'm working because I feel like it does reduce the sort of overall sensory overload that happens during the day. You know, and it's really nice, especially, I live in Chicago, so it's only nice half the year. Right. So when it's really nice, I want to be outside and that sort of thing. So I love it when it's dark. I love it when it's quiet. And that's when I'm more productive. So I think I probably would say that a half hour at night is better than a half hour during the day for me. And I might be able to get way more work done. Let's say I had 2 hours at night. And this is, again, non-scientific, and I haven't thought that much about it. But I feel like 2 hours at night for me would equal 4 hours during the day.
Yeah.
You know? So that's how I feel. And I think a lot of other people in the creative world kind of have similar outlooks on that.
Well, we'll come back to this because I want to talk about physical environments. But it does seem like it is really physical in the sense that how it and it's pretty personal how you react to light, how you react to the particular time of day. I mean, it seems like you've got a kind of cater your work environment. There's no one size fits all for people.
Yeah, which is why at our company we don't require people to be at the office. Yeah. You know, this is another thing because it's not just about the physical place, but it's also when is each person most not only productive, because that's sort of a, I don't know, it's sort of a dry term, but creative and interesting and thinking their best. So if someone's a night person, I'd much rather have them working for me at night than I would at 11 a.m. If I'm forcing someone to work at 11 a.m. and they're not really good workers at 11 a.m., then what am I getting out of them? I'm not getting anything. So I'd much rather them, you know, if someone wants to work a few hours in the morning and a few hours at night, that's totally fine with me. Now, a traditional office environment doesn't really allow that. So that's why we allow people to work from wherever they live, whenever they live, wherever it is, doesn't matter to us. As long as the work's getting done, it's interesting and it's well done, then we're totally comfortable with that.
What's the thing that that we're fighting against, do you think? What's the sense of resistance to this? Is it kind of the old Protestant, you know, Puritan work ethic? Is this an American thing? Is it we've just been doing it wrong? I mean, there's got to be something cultural embedded in us that keeps us from, you know, keeps managers, keeps corporate leaders from saying, yeah, maybe you should do this from home.
Yeah, well, I think part of it is tradition.
Yeah.
And I want to push back on the work ethic thing because some of the best workers I know are spontaneous workers, you know, who aren't scheduled from 9 to 5, you know.
Yeah.
So you can be very you can be an excellent worker and just work at night or work in the day or work 3 hours and take 4 hours off. And so that's the thing I want to push back against. But as far as what we're fighting against in general, I think it's tradition. I think a lot of the reasons why working at home or working remotely works these days is because there are new tools that are available that have never been available before. So we have, you know, hundreds of years of momentum. It's very hard to change momentum, you know, in anything. And the more massive an object is, the harder it is to change its direction. And I would say that the traditional work in the office scenario is very massive, long, consistent movement over hundreds of years of people doing things like this. So I think that this is a shift. Shifts are hard. They're unusual. I think it also typically challenges the value of managers because a lot of managers, a lot of people I know who are managers feel like they can't manage unless they can see people.
Yeah.
And I think we have to get over that. But again, I understand that it's a pattern that's been going on for a long, long time, so we're used to it. But I think we have to get over that and trust that people can do their work and treat people like adults and don't feel like they have to be under constant supervision to do great work. And so that's just a tough change for a lot of people, and I think it's generational, I think it's technological, and I think it's going to happen. It's already beginning to happen.
Yeah.
It's accelerating.
Jason Fried is with us. He's the co-founder and president of the web design company 37 Signals and co-author of the book Rework. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about why many of us can't seem to get our work done at work. Jason Fried is our guest. He's a software designer, the co-founder of the very popular web design company 37 Signals. And he's joining us to talk about the modern workplace. Well, one of the things that you've been talking about, which is really popular for a lot of people in offices, is the fact that meetings are just the worst. They're toxic, is the way you put it, and poisonous. And I wanted to have you talk about why it is, because you kind of have broken this down in your book. One thing I wanted to ask you about is you say that a lot of times in meetings, they're usually about words and abstract concepts, not real things. Explain what you mean.
Well, okay. So, and first of all, we do have meetings here,
right,
but they're very rare and they're the last resort. So
yeah,
I do believe in them, but I think the problem is that when they're the first resort, that's a problem. And that's what happens in a lot of workplaces is that any sort of questions come up and it's time to call a meeting, and then you pull a bunch of people into a room. And I'll get to the abstractions part in a second.
Yeah,
but I think
yeah.
the biggest problem, though, with meetings is that companies forget how costly they are.
Yeah.
And when people call a meeting, let's say it's for an hour, the only way a one-hour meeting ever happens is if there's only one person there for an hour, which is never the case. There's always at least two or three or four or five. And so when you start thinking about five people being pulled off their work for an hour, it's no longer a one-hour meeting. It's a five-hour meeting.
Yeah.
And if you think about what you can get done with those five people each working an hour, you'd see that the cost of the meeting is exceptionally high, and you'd much rather have that time back. So I'm a big fan of thinking about meetings in terms of as cost centers, and
yeah.
that's a great way to think about, to get companies to start to be, think about, like, are these things really worth it? Because I don't feel like a lot of companies really think about how expensive a meeting actually is. And it's not just money, it's time, it's attention, it's distractions, all those things. So that's the first problem I have with meetings, is that I don't think they're worth it,
yeah.
fundamentally worth it, in most cases. Now, as far as the abstractions, you know, a lot of meetings are about there's a lot of discussion going on, which is fine. It's totally fine to discuss things.
Yeah.
But the problem with words, and I love words, but the problem with words is that everybody sort of perceives them a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And so while, you know, this happens a million times, I'm sure a lot of listeners have gone through this, where there's a meeting, there are things that are discussed, everyone says they agree on something, they leave the meeting, they go do their work, they come back to the next meeting, and all of a sudden, you know, what's presented is not what people thought it was going to be. And they said, well, that's what I thought you meant. And they said, well, I didn't mean it that way, I meant it this way. And there's all these disagreements. There's basically this illusion of agreement that comes from big meetings with lots of people saying their say or having their say. So I feel like if you're going to have a meeting about something, it's always better to point to something and look at something and get more concrete about what it is that you're discussing in a physical way rather than this abstract discussion, which just leads to more and more discussions, which leads to more and more meetings. And it's just it's this thing you just don't feel like when you leave a meeting that you've really conquered something. I feel like you're just feeling like you're setting up for the next one.
Yeah.
And there's going to be disagreements about what just happened. And that's what I've found happens. And I've talked to a lot of people about this. And that's what they find happens. So they're just too abstract. They're too expensive. They're often too long. And they involve too many different voices. And it's just a very difficult way, I think, to actually make decisions.
One thing you also talk about is that they often include one, you know, the one jerk in the office who wastes people's time. I don't want to make too much of that point, but I mean,
yeah.
it does sort of raise a bigger question, which is because you talk about, for example, collaboration is often like people getting together to collaborate. It's not often the case that they're really actually solving problems. Sometimes this is about just saying people want to be heard. You know, they want to say something. They want to get recognition. Sometimes they're playing office politics. So, you know, we're human creatures and we have these social things that are going on. And that seems like one of the obstacles is that sometimes we just want to talk or we want to interact. And it's not always about getting something done or really even collaborating.
Very true. I mean, you're right. And there's nothing you can do about that, really, except for create fewer opportunities for those sort of office politics stuff to bubble up. And
yeah.
these things often bubble up when there's some turf wars and meetings, especially when you have multiple departments in a meeting. And by the way, conversations are important. I don't want to sound like I'm saying like everyone should be isolated doing things on their own, because that's not what I mean. But I do mean that having a lot of these sort of meetings and we have a lot of different departments together, that there's a lot of turf war stuff that happens and actually a lot less work, a lot more sort of quiet fighting than there is actual work getting done. Something I heard recently, I don't know how true this is, but I thought it was really great. One of the things I don't like about meetings typically is that people really come unprepared.
Right.
People are asked to prepare, but no one has time to prepare because they're actually doing the other work that they have to do in the limited amount of time that they have. So something I heard about what they do at Amazon at certain meetings, at least meetings with Jeff Bezos specifically, is that they don't give people materials to prepare. They actually work the preparation into the meeting itself. So for example, if there's a one-hour meeting set up, and there's, you know, seven pages people are supposed to have read. Instead of starting the meeting assuming people have read it, they actually start the meeting with like 10 minutes of silent time for everyone to actually read the materials together to themselves around the table.
Wow.
That way they force everyone to actually be prepared, because preparation is part of the meeting itself, which I thought was a really great idea. Instead of assuming that everyone's going to come prepared, and we all know the reality of that, which is most people don't, then you work the preparation itself into the meeting, and I think that might lead to much more productive meetings.
Well, you talk about the two M's. You know, meetings is one, and then the other one is managers. Often the manager's role is just sort of interrupting people. They're not terribly helpful in terms of institutions sometimes. But so what is the structure supposed to look like? Is there even do we even need a manager in some of these structures? Is there supposed to be some kind of hierarchy?
Yeah, and I'm a manager, so like I'm sort of ripping on myself here a little bit. But I think what's important is that managers aren't purely delegators. Because the work of delegation is sort of also the work of interruption in many ways. That I think the best way to have this is to have working managers, people who are team leaders who actually are also doing the work. So here at 37 Signals, everyone who would be considered a manager is also actively doing the work. Their hands are dirty just like everyone else's, doing the work itself. They've not been promoted to a point where they don't know the work anymore. They do the work. And I think that's super important, because if you're managing people who actually do the work, you have to do the work too to understand what it is that you're asking people to do. It's when a manager is promoted to a level that they don't understand the work anymore and they ask people to do the work, and then they have a hard time judging it, and then they just become this sort of in some ways dead weight, and they slow things down instead of speed things up. So I'm a big fan of people who are close enough to the work that they can jump in and do it, and they do it on a daily basis, but they also are leaders, because I do believe that groups or companies need leadership. Humans need leadership. That's, again, getting back to human nature. We do look to certain people to lead us in certain ways, and that's a good thing. Yeah. But we want to make sure they can do the work too.
Let's take a call from Joe, who's in Stonington, Connecticut. Joe, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Jason, a couple of things here. Lately, I see a lot of offices, particularly startups, where it's like the library at college. It's like everybody's in gang tables sitting right next to each other. I mean, not even in cubes, which we thought were terribly, you know, noisy and invasive. So are we backsliding? And second, I know you're familiar with the work of Susan Cain, who talks about introverts and extroverts. And I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about how you see introverts working or extroverts working in creative things and introverts working in what I might call real-time work, like a call center.
Yeah.
I know our call center where I used to work, they loved it, the open office, because they could help each other out in real time, sort of like service people help each other out in a restaurant.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this, because thank you very much, by the way, because this is I think this social component part is a really important thing to talk about, Jason. You've admitted to being an introvert, that you don't socialize all of that much, but I get a sense that you're also hoping that the workplace doesn't become like a library. So what is the part of, you know, the social dynamic supposed to be?
Yeah, you know, first of all, those are both really great questions, because they're challenging questions. I think that – so our office has what we call library rules, okay, which basically means that you should treat people as if they were in a library. So when you walk into a library, everyone knows the etiquette, which is you kind of keep your voice down. You don't bother people. People are studying. People are learning. People are working on things.
Yeah.
It's not that you can't talk, but you sort of keep your voice down. You don't interrupt others. And that's how we treat our office. And that we should assume that people are here to learn and to work, and they need their own space, and so we don't interrupt people at full volume. If you need to pull someone into a room to have a conversation, we have room set up for that. But in the open plan that we have, that the idea is don't really interrupt people and keep your voice down. So that's the library part that we have. But as far as the shared table space, I see the same thing that Joe sees, which is that I go into a lot of offices and people are crammed in. And they don't have any personal space. And I think it's very hard for people to think when they don't have their own space. I think that clutter is actually another form of interruption that isn't often considered. And when people are packed so tightly together, you know, it's just hard to be really thoughtful in those sort of situations. So I would encourage companies to give people more space. In fact, here when we designed our office, we made sure that people had a good 10, 12 feet of space behind them. So when they backed up in their chair, they never hit anybody else. They don't sit next to anybody. Everyone sits sort of facing each other with a little bit of a divider. And that way you feel, when you look ahead and you look to your left and you look to your right and you move your chair back, you don't ever sense the presence of somebody else, which means that you have your own personal space to do your own thing. So I'm a big fan of that sort of situation. As far as introverts and extroverts, I am definitely introverted. A lot of people who work here are. A lot of people who work in the programming world and the software world are as well. I do think, though, that it's very important to have a mix of people, and we have a good mix here. But I think that we do trend more towards the introverted side, and I think that that does hurt us sometimes, too, because I think that work should also be a fun place to go, and socialization is definitely a fun thing to do. And the fact that we're spread out in so many different places, we have 38 employees at 37 Signals, and 25 of those are in 25 different locations around the world. We don't get to see each other that often. So because of that, you need a central place to still have these social conversations. So we have we use a product called Campfire, which is a chat room where we have these conversations. So we socialize, you know, in a different way, and it's not face to face, but it's sort of in text and images and video, and that works well. But I do think that and like Susan Cain wrote that book called Quiet, which is all about, you know, introverts and how to make that work in a workplace. And it's a great book, and I recommend reading it, especially for people who are not introverted, to help understand what it's like to be introverted. Anyway, this is sort of a long answer, but I do think that a mix is important. I don't think you want to go too much in one direction, because then you start to exclude people. So, for example, if you have a very extroverted environment, it's very hard to employ an introvert. And if you have a very introverted environment, it's very hard to employ an extrovert. So you do need a mix. I think a mix and a balance is a really good thing to do. So when we hire people, we sort of consider their personalities too, and how well they'll fit in with the other people at the company. So I think that that's something we need to consider, not just skills, not just resumes, not just years of experience, but also, you know, the type of person they are, how well they'll fit with others. Do they add more energy to the company? Do they take some away? For example, if there's too much sort of outward energy going on, maybe it's better to have, you know, to bring in someone who's not going to contribute as much to that, but to pull it back in the other direction so you don't go too far on one side or the other. I think in general, extremes are bad. So we like to try and keep it as balanced as possible.
You write about workaholism and this idea of, you know, working these ridiculous hours. And you say working more doesn't mean you care more, get more done. It just means you work more. You describe it as people sometimes who make up for, you know, sometimes intellectual laziness with just this kind of brute force. What is this about? This is about efficiency, but also about, I don't know, what do you, workaholism, it's such an interesting thing. And it seems like it's kind of a... we seem plagued with it in some ways today.
A lot of it comes down to industry as well. So in our industry, which is software, it runs rampant, and I think it's very toxic. The problem is that there's sort of this weird badge of honor that comes with putting in 80-hour weeks, 90-hour weeks. You hear people talking about how I put in 90 hours, and they're proud of it. And I feel like that's bad news. For a variety of reasons. For one, I don't think people are really truly creative or thoughtful when they're exhausted. And you are exhausted if you're putting in 90 hours a week. I don't see how there's any way around that. Certainly, you can put it in occasionally if there's some crazy week and you have to do it. But if it becomes habit, that's going to be a problem. And I'm a general believer that this goes for anything in life, right? The more you do something, the more you get used to it, the more you'll continue to do it. You'd build up habits. So if you think that the only way for you to get work done is to work these ridiculous hours in your early 20s, you're not going to develop the skills you need to work fewer hours later on in life. And you're going to brute force everything and just, you know, go forever and just try and, you know, burn all the midnight oil. And it's not sustainable over long term. So I'm more a fan of measured work. And look, there's very few things that absolutely need to get done at 9 p.m. at night. Let's just face it, if you've been working the whole day. So things can wait till tomorrow. It's okay. Certainly if there's an emergency or whatever, okay, you put in a long day. But consistent long days don't lead, in my mind, to really creative solutions. They lead to exhaustion, and that's not where really great ideas come from. So I think that you need moments You need a lot of the great ideas that you'll form in your life, I think, come from not thinking about them.
Yeah.
You know, like you'll be in the shower in the morning, you'll be on a walk in the weekend, or you'll be playing with your family, wherever it might be, and ideas pop into your head. Those are the moments. It's not when you're thinking incredibly hard over 12 hours about something. It's when you're not thinking about it that great ideas come from. So you need to allow for those gaps and those pauses in your work life. And you don't have those gaps and pauses if you're putting in 90 or 100 hours.
Yeah, and you say in your book, send people home at 5. I mean, you want them to have a life outside of work too.
They have to. If they, it comes again back to balance. Extremes, I don't think, are very good. So, you know, you want people to go home and enjoy themselves, because if not, they're going to burn out. And burnout leads to shorter, let me step back. I think the best teams are teams that have been together for a long period of time, because you get to know each other really well and you can push hard on each other and you don't have to worry about offending each other because you know like sort of where someone's limits are and you have a lot of goodwill in the bank. You don't have a lot of goodwill in the bank with brand new people all the time. And so if people are burning out regularly and you have to hire new people all the time to replace the people who are burned out, you end up with this situation where you have a lot of fresh faces around all the time, which is healthy in some ways. But it's also really hard to push hard against fresh faces because you don't know each other, so you're very careful. And I think great ideas come from some of those battles, from people who know each other really well, who know how to push and get the best out of each other. So burnout leads to a variety of things. For one, like people are going to leave your company earlier, which I don't think is necessarily a good thing. It also leads to people not being very creative over the long term because they just get exhausted. And then people don't look forward to coming into the office if they're just exhausted. And then all these things, it leaches out, it infects other things. Nothing at work happens in isolation. Mm. You know, it's an ecosystem basically, just like anything else. And if you pollute the waters here, you're going to damage something else over there. And I think workaholism and long hours and exhaustion pollutes a lot of different things. So you want to keep the pollution out of the system if you can.
Jason Fried is with us, the co-founder and president of the web design company 37 Signals, co-author along with David Heinmeier Hansen of the book Rework. Joe, thanks very much for the call. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jason Fried, co-founder, president of the design company 37 Signals and co-author of the book Rework and the forthcoming book Remote. Let's go back to the phones. Kim is with us in Salt Lake. Kim, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that I'm working temporarily for a company who is considered a cutting-edge employer with cutting-edge state-of-the-art facilities. In the portion of the building where I work, there's close to 100 desks, 100 people. There's no dividers. We don't have cubicles. And anytime someone gets onto a conference call, which happens 3-4 times a day for some of these people, everyone can hear everything that they're saying. It is the most distracting environment I've ever worked in, and I'm really grateful this is a temporary job because it sort of makes me crazy. I'm actually working from home today, and I'm thankful to have that convenience because it is so challenging to be in that environment.
Kim, we lost you there, that last part. Just starting to fade. But we got the point, I guess, Jason Fried. I mean, and this is the interesting, you talk about this acoustic environments, how your workspace, you try to choose material like cork and foam and felt, a lot of that. So you're really sensitive to these acoustics.
Yeah, I think acoustics is highly underrated in office spaces. And just like Kim was saying, you know, these open, especially in open workplaces, which is sort of the norm these days, you know, you hear someone talk and it carries. There's nothing to interrupt that sound. It just goes throughout the entire building or entire floor or room or whatever it is. And it's super distracting. It's very hard to think when you're hearing someone else's conversation going on. So one of the things we decided was, first of all, there's two things. There's the cultural thing where you have to have these sort of library rules where there's an etiquette about the volume of your voice and just how you interrupt people. And then you also have to have spaces for people to go if they do need to have a full volume conversation or a phone call. They need to be able to go to a space that's optimized for that. And so when we built our office, we thought a lot about this. So we designed in phone booths. So we have little phone booths in our office that are acoustically pretty sound. They're not soundproof, but really quite good. Yeah. And we have a few of them. They're very small. There's a little desk in there and a phone. And you can go in there and have a private conversation and not interrupt anybody else and also have full privacy. We also have these team rooms set up, which are also acoustically sound, where multiple people can sit in a room together around a really nice table with all the tools they need to have a conversation at full volume, but not interrupt anybody who's working on the outside. So we thought a lot about that. It's more than, you know, when you build an office, it's more than square footage. It's more than the software you're going to have in the space. It's more than the logo on the door. You've got to think about what is it really like to work in this space? What kind of environment are we creating? Because not only that, but like a lot of these leases are long, 5-10 years. You're setting up a legacy for your company at this moment when you build this space, when you move into an office. So the decisions you make early on are going to have a huge impact on future productivity and happiness of your employees. So anyway, that's something we thought a lot about. And I would encourage other companies to think a lot about and give a lot of thought to acoustics. The one other thing that we didn't think about, which I didn't realize until we had the office, which is a weird thing, which is when you have an open kitchen that's open to the rest of the office, when people are cooking food, it's also a big interruption because you smell the food and you start to get hungry.
Right.
And so we didn't think about that. But that's like another thing that's a distraction. So around like 11 to 1, like everyone just wants to eat.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, another thing to maybe think about. But acoustics is an easy one, and I highly encourage people to think about it. It really has a big impact on people's productivity.
Kim Glechko, thanks very much. Back to the phone. Stephen is with us in Salt Lake. Stephen, hi.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I made a comment, and now after hearing this thing about acoustics, I'm sort of at the other end. I live equidistant from my office at the U and the closest coffee shop, and I thrive on the noise in the coffee shop.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
It's because it's a living environment, and it's not connected with what I find is too much silence at the university in my office. There are sometimes I see friends and they want to talk and I need to get something done, so I say I can't talk right now. But I find under other circumstances that being interrupted at a certain moment is a blessing because it gives me time off from what I'm doing. And I teach online, so I can just teach from the coffee shop. And it also, it's sort of a sense of, you know, I lived in Europe for a long time, and it's like hanging out outdoors, because I can do that right now, and see life go by. All these different people come in, get their coffee, go out. And I find that incredibly stimulating.
Huh. Yeah. Well, isn't that, Jason Fried, isn't that the point, letting people control their environment? If you like it in a coffee shop, cool. If you like it in a library, that's cool too. The point is letting them have that control, I guess.
That's exactly the point. And by the way, I agree. There's a difference between sort of coffee shop ambient noise and sort of life going by than business-style conference calls. I think that if a coffee shop was a set of phones where people are having conversations about the work that they're doing all day long, it wouldn't be as comfortable as an environment. So I do love the idea of working, and I do it sometimes too, where I'll go work in a coffee shop, it'll be loud, but it's this white noise, ambient noise, because you're not actually involved in the other people's conversations and they have nothing to do with what you're doing. So that's kind of a nice place to go sometimes too. But yeah, the fundamental point here is that not every environment is suited for every person, just like not every block of time is suited for each individual person. But in traditional corporate America, it's 9 to 5, and it's you got to be at the office. Mm-hmm. And so think about how difficult that must be for so many people who work in those environments, because everyone's different. So at 37 Signals, if you want to work in a coffee shop, fine. If you want to work at the office, fine. We provide different environments. If you want to work from home, fine. I don't care where you work. Whatever you're most comfortable is what's most important to me, because that's when you're going to do your best work. And so if you want – coffee shop's the best place for you, great. Work's the best place for you, great. Home's the best place for you, great. Totally up to you. We don't care. As long as you're doing great work, that's all I care about.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Stephen, thanks very much. So there's a kind of a theme in some ways in some of the things that you write about in Rework. One of the things you talk about is, you know, you're not crazy about these five-year plans or these long financial projections. You're not crazy about these mission statements, because in some ways they're sort of putting off the here and now, it seems like. And one thing you say is planning is guessing. And it's, are you getting at this idea that we need to be nimble, we need to be willing to improvise and kind of live for the moment as opposed to thinking about what's going to happen in, you know, 3 years or 5 years?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of thinking ahead and thinking deeply about things, but I'm not a big fan of writing those things down that I just thought about. So that's the difference.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of, if you got to think, you got to be creative, you got to think about, like, how does this impact this and where are we going, what's the strategy and that stuff. So I love that kind of thinking. But I think the moment you codify it and write it down, that's when you start to go in the wrong direction, because then you're saying, well, we decided we're going to do this no matter what, because we had this long session about it, and now it's now on, you know, it's in writing. We've all signed off to it. And then you sort of paralyze yourself because you're unable to change because you've all agreed on a particular direction or whatever. So now, that's not to say that the other way is always better. I mean, sometimes I get frustrated here, and I know other people get frustrated here, where we make a decision and then 3 months later we change our mind. That's frustrating too. But I'd rather have that opportunity and that option than I would to be fixed in place for 3 or 4 or 5 years because we made a decision 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. So I do think it's very important to constantly question, constantly think about things. You can think long term. We're a very long term company, and that we've been around for, you know, 14 years now. I want to be around for 50 years or whatever it is. And so we're long term in that way. But the way we work day to day is a little bit more spontaneous, and if we see a new direction we want to go in or a new thing we want to try, I'd much rather do that than not be able to do it.
Yeah. You say standing for something isn't about just writing it down. It's about believing it and living it. So, walking the walk, I guess.
You have to. I mean, and that comes back to sort of something we talked about earlier, which is just culture, and that, I don't think you can invent and create a culture in writing or in rules. Like you said, culture is, or like I said, and you said, is a culture byproduct of consistent behavior, which is that, you know, if you want to create an environment where people are trusted and people do great work and they can work on their own, it's not a set of rules that make that happen. It's actually action. So you have to, if you say that you want people to work where they're best, you have to let them work where they're best. And if you say that it's okay to work whenever you want, then you have to allow them to do that. And so that's really what creates the culture, is the consistent behavior and not so much the word. So that's what I'm more a fan of.
Let's go back to the phones. Robin is with us in Salt Lake. Robin, hi.
Hi. First of all, I want to say your idea of balance and flexibility is great. I wish more people thought that way.
Thank you.
But anyway, my question is, how do you present this meeting information to a supervisor who loves meetings because it gives them a place, a captive audience, and a place to talk? They're the ones calling the meetings.
But... yeah.
This is the thing, right, Jason? I mean, how do you, it's one thing for you as the manager or the head of the innovative company, but if you're the grunt, what do you do?
It's tough. I mean, I'm not going to say it's easy. This is not an easy change. No changes are. I think the only way you ever really convince someone of something is to let them see the results. So if you can somehow convince your manager to say, can we just not call this one meeting? Can we just work through it individually, or can we do this a different way? Can we just try it once?
Yeah.
And if you can show some results there or some outcome that was better or some progress that was made in that amount of time that you would have spent the meeting, instead you can show some results or some work or some ideas or whatever it is that's different than would have come out from the meeting. If you can show that the outcome was better, then you have a shot at replicating that opportunity. But it is hard. There's no silver bullets here. I think it's just a matter of slowly chipping away at the way things have always been done and showing that there's other ways to do things, and that not only showing that there's other ways, but actually proving that there's other ways. Results speak for themselves, and you just have to have somehow convince someone to give you the opportunity to present a different way of doing things and to show the results. And this is what I recommend. For example, we allow people to work from wherever. But if you're a company, let's say everyone's required to go to the office every day, it's very hard to change that to a remote working environment. So the way I recommend it is just like start with one day a month. Let people work from home the third Thursday of every month. Like that's a very small step and you can see how it works. And then maybe it turns into every other Thursday. Maybe it turns into 3 days a week, or maybe there's one whole week where everyone gets to work from home. But you got to take these small steps. Change is hard enough. Making enormous changes is incredibly difficult. So you got to take one small thing at a time, prove that it works, prove that it's okay, prove that if everyone gets to work from home on Thursdays, that the world doesn't end. You know, then you can say, okay, this isn't maybe so bad. Maybe we can do a little bit more of this and see where the, and maybe it turns out that it's a hybrid approach. I mean, that's kind of what we have here, where some people come to the office and some people don't. Whoever people are comfortable is fine. But you can't get there unless you take some small steps to try a few very simple things out. There's very little risk to this. And that's the only way I think you can really enact this kind of change in a company-wide level.
We've got about a minute left. I want to ask you this because the sense of scale seems really important, because one of the things you write about is, you know, you ask this question, why is it that we need to grow? You know, you question the idea of why expansion is always the goal. And it seems you say small businesses, that can be a destination in of itself. This seems really important to the way you sort of think about things in the scheme.
Yeah, a lot of the things that we do and a lot of the ways we're able to do things we do is because we've intentionally kept our company small in terms of the amount of people that work here. Yeah. Our revenues, our profits are significantly higher than most small companies, and we're far more profitable than even many big companies. But we've decided not to hire more people. And we have 38 people. We've used to be four, so we've certainly grown, but we've grown very slowly, very methodically, very carefully. And because of that, it allows us to do a lot of the things that we want to do here. And I think that that's one of the great messages of small businesses, is you don't have to run your business like a big business. You can do it your way, your own way. You can experiment. You can try new things. And the smaller your company, the easier it is to make these changes. So I think that growth is something businesses are obsessed with, but I don't think they have to be.
It's Jason Fried. He is the co-founder and president of the company 37 Signals, co-author along with David Heinmeier Hansen of the book Rework, joined us from Chicago. And Jason, thanks very much for the time.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to Sarah Liu at Chicago Public Radio for engineering help today. And the program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.